I really never thought I'd be in Houston sober. That's true. And I'm grateful to have been able to spend the last couple of days among you. I arrived Friday knowing a couple of people a little bit. Frank and I had lunch in San Francisco a month or so ago, and a couple other folks I've met as we've trudged along. I find out John lived in across the bay, in the west part of the bay, called San Francisco, for evidently eons, but I never get there because I'm so busy. So I met him here. And in the space of maybe a couple of hours or a couple of days, I start connecting with other women and men. And that makes my world a lot bigger. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come and spend time with you, because otherwise I would have been pacing back and forth in my house a lot this weekend, I think. I wasn't real glad to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to just start by saying that. I didn't see this as the accomplishment of a life's dream. Figuring that if I try real hard, I can hang out with all the people my mother used to warn me about. And I wasn't glad to be here for a very long time. I would go to meetings, and there were always people who were grateful to be alcoholics at the meeting. And I just glazed over. I figured, who cares? I wasn't glad to be here. I was real glad I wasn't out there, but there's a gray area in between, you know, as you kind of edge into recovery. And I was sober over a year, and I went to a meeting out in the San Fernando Valley in the Los Angeles area. And there was this character who got up and said that his name was whoever, and he was an alcoholic, and we all shouted back his name and said hello. And he said that he was not real grateful that he was an alcoholic, but he was real grateful that we were. And that was the first true statement about gratitude that I could connect with on the program. Because being that you were alcoholics, you gave me a place I could come to. And there weren't a lot of places I could come to when I got sober. I just didn't feel safe a lot. There was a lot of not being safe. I don't have a great drunkalogue. I really wish I did. I'm very impressed with people who do. I love folks who started drinking a little white wine in Sausalito and end up in Rio de Janeiro with $700,000 worth of cocaine and a dead body in the room. You know, I love that. So they call AA, you know, right away. They know. That's not my story. I never spent a night in jail. I never got a drunk driving ticket. I never got into trouble with the law. I never really got into major trouble with my family other than I didn't speak to them from the time of 15 on. And I was such a bad drunk that I never even got a tattoo, which is pretty embarrassing. When I was hospitalized for this little drinking problem, I was the only person there that did not have a tattoo. And I went around with my hand over my arm, hoping that they would think there was a tattoo underneath. And I was such a colossal failure. So I thought that if you knew my story, you'd ask me to leave. That I just wasn't disciplined enough or hardworking enough to really be a serious alcoholic. I was just dying, and had just been dying for years, and it may have continued for more years. The story of my drinking is depression and overwhelming anxiety and lots of fear and not feeling safe anywhere. During that whole time, I did manage to hold down a job. I became a licensed credentialed teacher in the state of California. I held responsible things and showed up a lot, and I got sober when I was in graduate school in Berkeley, and that was my introduction to the program. I had been to one meeting earlier when I was in college. I went to college up in Spokane, Washington, and drank a little socially up there, and would go out occasionally to an Indian reservation in a town called Nephilim, and there wasn't anything to do there other than drink and smoke dope, of course. But they had a little AA meeting in this village inside of the Catholic Church, and it was a real dull Saturday night. And so a group of us went to the meeting, and I was real impressed with you people. I really was. You talked about feelings, which I could not do, and you talked about yourselves, and you talked about prayer and God, and I was very, very moved, and I wanted nothing to do with you. I just, which way is out? Part of the reason for that was that I just wasn't done yet. I knew that if I said, boy, do I connect with you folks, you'd expect me to do something. And I wasn't ready to do anything. That, I think, was in 1971. When I came in to recovery the last time was in 1976. And that I haven't had to drink or use since that time. And I find that shocking, disturbing, that I haven't been able to do that. My first meeting was in Oakland, California, and it was an old-timers meeting. I called central office knowing nothing about AA. I never saw the great alcoholic films. I never saw Days of Wine and Roses. I didn't see, you know, I'll Cry Tomorrow and the Susan Hayward story and the classics. Whenever those came on the television, I got so nervous I'd leave the room. I just couldn't watch it to the end. So I came in real dumb. I didn't read any books about Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor in Los Angeles is one of the real hopeless, helpless variety, who's been sober some 15 years, but when he was in college, he didn't have a drink until he was 21 because he took the pledge. But he did term papers on the big book, and his father was in AA, and he was an expert on AA and recovery before he ever had a drink. And he always... He always points out to me, as I come up with lots of new insights and ideas, he says simple things like, Tom, insights are not our problem. Our problem is our behavior. What you need to do is change your behavior, not your insights. I hate things like that, because I prefer lots of insights to having to do anything about them. So... Anyway, at this meeting in Oakland, I guess that's what I was talking about. This was an old-timers meeting. I called AA. I said, is there a meeting anywhere in the Bay Area this weekend? And they said yes. And see, I didn't know how many meetings you had. I didn't know where you had meetings. I didn't know how long meetings were. I, dumb. So I showed up figuring this was the only AA meeting in the North American continent. And everybody in the room was 6,000 years old. And they all had short hair and tattoos, and socks. They wore a lot of socks at that meeting, and clearly held down jobs. Now, as a graduate student, I found all of that pretty intimidating, and I was 29 years old, and I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that had to get sober. And as far as that room was concerned, I sure was. I mean, they were still concerned about the fact that Dewey lost the presidency in 1948. You know, this was a progressive group. So, I just sat there and listened, and I'm a survivor from a dysfunctional family, and I learned how to pick up the language real fast, and I can check you out pretty quickly. And I have always identified with chameleons because they blend in with surroundings very fast, and I can do that, and I survive nicely that way, thank you. Dumb, but nicely. And the guy who was chairing the meeting had a little tiny white Tom Dewey mustache, and he said that we all knew his story and he wouldn't bore us with it, and he laughed. Everyone in the room laughed, so did I. I did not know what was funny, but it occurred to me that I should have been there last weekend when he told his story, you know, because that's obviously what happened. There was a man in the room who chaired next. This was a discussion meeting. Most of our meetings there are discussion meetings. In Alameda County, we think that speaker meetings smack of monarchy, and we don't like it. So we do a discussion meeting. And this next fellow who talked said he had a real good week. I think that was the topic. How was your week? And he said that he felt so good that afternoon he got up the energy and discipline to cut the front lawn. I did not want what he had. Nor did I have a front lawn. That's also true. I mean, I didn't know anything about lawns. Right now, you know, if someone comes into the Berkeley Fellowship and says, not only did I cut the front lawn this week, but I also did laundry, I give them the mental health award for the week. I think that is phenomenal to be able, but at that time, I was not impressed. There was a married couple at this meeting, male, female, and they were married to each other. And they were talking to each other. And they were laughing with each other and being openly affectionate. I haven't seen anything that bizarre in years. And then it was my turn to talk. And I said, my name is Tom and I'm an alcoholic. And they all shouted back, "Hi, Tom!" Which takes getting used to. It was 6 months before I didn't flinch when people did that to me. It seemed so rude, just so rude. And what people were doing, they were telling a little bit about their week, and so I did. And this was a Friday night meeting, and I told them that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, which was true. What I didn't tell them was that it was only beer. It was in a pizza parlor in Santa Clara. I drank about, I don't know how much, but enough to pee a lot, and I didn't even get vaguely buzzed. How embarrassing. If I had known that was going to be my last drink, I would have done it differently. But you just don't know the day or the hour. A boom struck sober. So I told them that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, and when I told them that, this group of women and men with whom I had nothing in common burst into applause. And that had never happened to me before. I had tried not drinking before, once up to 3 months, as a matter of fact. And friends of mine would say things like, "Tom, how's it going?" And I would say, "Well, you know, it's really amazing. I haven't had a drink now for 5 days, and I feel a lot better, and I'm working better, and life is pretty good." And they never clapped. They instead looked embarrassed, or they'd change the subject. Or they'd ask the children to leave the room. They don't know what the proper response is. I was sober a year, and I was interviewing for a job in Los Angeles at a school that I had taught at before, at away for a couple of years, and I was trying to update the president of the school about my recovery. I mean, in the past 3 years, you know, I got a degree and so forth, and I got sober. So I told him, because I wanted him to know about me, I said, I haven't had a drink or a joint or a pill in almost 8 months now. And he looked at me and said, "Have you seen the new gymnasium?" They don't know what to do. One fellow, when I was 5 years sober, I sat a fellow I down the street and I said, "You know, today is my fifth birthday. I haven't had a drink or a joint or a pill in 5 years." And he said, "I'm so sorry." Well, when these people burst into applause, it occurred to me that they knew what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night, and I had never met anybody like that before. And I just shut up. I had nothing more to say. And there was a character next to me who had just come out of prison, where he got sober. This was not a nice man. This was a man, when you heard his story, you were glad we had prisons. You were just thrilled. And he spent a lot of time in solitary confinement. He was such a people pleaser, you know, just charming and friendly. Well, he had been out on the street for about 10 days when I met him. And he told me, "And what do you people do when you don't drink all day?" I didn't know that. I couldn't imagine what you did all day when you didn't drink. And he said, "How do you recover? What is the program?" And he said, in a very deep voice, "We here at Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings," which I did not know. I didn't know what you here at Alcoholics Anonymous did, and whatever a lot of meetings was, I was willing to do it. Now, what's true is when I came in here, I was exhausted and burned out and worn very, 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 very thin, and I needed to rest a lot, and I would sleep for sometimes 18 hours at a crack without even turning over. And I figured, you know, if I rested up a lot, I could probably make a couple of meetings a month, which, as far as I was concerned, was a lot of meetings. It really was. And then he said, "We go to lots of meetings." Then he said, "And we don't drink in between meetings." Which was news to me. Something fell into place. Something in my brain said, Tom, if you go to a meeting at night, this whole thing would be easier. And I'm very grateful in looking back that he did not say, we don't drink a day at a time, because I've tried doing stuff a day at a time, and it doesn't work. I can't do anything a day at a time, because I'm clever enough to know that you say day at a time, but you mean forever. And I will think myself out of that one real fast. But when he said, we don't drink in between meetings, what fell into place was, Tom, if you go to a meeting tonight at 8:30, which in Alameda County, our meetings were from 8:30 to 10, and I just believe that's the way God likes them. And I didn't go to a noon meeting or a morning meeting or a meeting at any other time for the first 3 years of my sobriety. I didn't know you could. I really didn't. I knew people went to noon meetings. I didn't think that was the program. Real meetings are 8:30 to 10, you see. I was a little rigid. But I said, if I went to a meeting and I had 8:30, I would leave the meeting at 10 o'clock, and all I would have to do is not drink until 8:30 the next night, which was not 24 hours. It was 22 and a half. And for some reason, where 24 hours was not possible, 22 and a half was. I don't know why that's true, but it just wasn't. Now, it wasn't fun, but it was possible. So we went to lots of meetings. We didn't drink in between meetings. And then he said, and we don't use no dope. Which had also never occurred to me. I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. And I, you know, why am I so depressed? You know, well, I was sober a year or two when it occurred to me that if you consume vast amounts of depressants on a daily basis, you get depressed. I thought it was the church or the president or my parents. I thought that was why I was depressed. No, it was because of all these wonderful things I was taking to relax. Depressed forever. So I just did. That became my program. I went to lots of meetings. I didn't drink in between meetings, and I didn't use no dope. And that was that. I could understand that. I could follow that. That was clear, and I just started doing a lot of these things. They talked a lot about sponsorship, too. They kept asking, do you have a sponsor? Got a sponsor yet? Do you have a sponsor? And I hate saying no, being such a people pleaser, so I figured I would get a sponsor just so I could say, yes, I have a sponsor. Thank you. Now, how do you find one? How do you find one? Well, they were saying, well, look for someone who has something you want. Well, I was afraid of all those people. And I didn't know what I wanted anyway. I was going to lots of meetings. I wasn't drinking in between meetings. I wasn't using no dope. And I finally found a guy named James who was a couple of years younger than I was. That was important. Age was important. He was a Vietnam vet. He had a lot of tattoos. Ideal sponsor for me. And I could sit in the car with him and not scream. He was safe to be with. He did not make me uncomfortable. So I asked him to be my sponsor. I actually wanted his sponsor to be my sponsor, and his sponsor was an active member of the Communist Party the day he got sober, and had been so for a long time, and he was raised as a communist. He had to learn the Lord's Prayer after he got here, stuff like that. He could sing the Internationale and wanted us to end an occasional meeting with that, which we probably could have, and it probably would have worked just as well, but we didn't. So, you know how we hate change. I was afraid of asking him, though, so when I asked James to be my sponsor, I thought things that were true would trickle down, you know? James was 3 months more sober than I was, and his sponsor was 3 months more sober than he was, so anything that we knew was fresh information. It wasn't like, oh, I vaguely remember that. It was, yeah, I just left that, and I know what you mean. And we talk about it real intensely. Now, what they don't tell you is what to do with the sponsor once you've got one. You get one, but then what, you see? So I would listen at meetings. And what you're supposed to do, evidently, is wait until there is this awful crisis. And then delay until around 3 or 4 in the morning and call your sponsor. And be hysterical. And then your sponsor is supposed to say something very wise and very wonderful, and you're supposed to take that back to your home group and quote your sponsor. That's what you're supposed to do. And my sponsor said, you see, and so I was waiting for that. And I was in crisis a lot, especially when the narcotic began wearing off. As I said, I was real depressed, and I took large amounts of depressants. And when you stop taking depressants, you start waking up. And I did not wake up polite, and I did not wake up happy. The feelings, around 3 months sober, just after they stopped saying hello to you, I started feeling for the first time in years, and the feelings I began feeling were rage and fear and hate and rage. And then occasionally, I would just fall asleep from exhaustion, because it is exhausting being that angry all the time. But then I would wake up and just be so angry again. And it would come in these waves, and it would be very inappropriate. I would get this wave of rage at 3 a.m, no one home but me. Or 3 p.m. in a room full of people. You know, just come. So it was like being Godzilla for a while. And that kept happening regularly for the next 18 months. And I was wanting to get over this real quickly, and it wouldn't go away. It was very embarrassing. So I would call James, and I would just... it was always crisis, and it was always awful, and it was always them. And I would ventilate and be hysterical. And he would say, what step are you on? I'm going to lots of meetings. I'm not drinking in between meetings, and I'm not using no dope. That's the step I'm on, you see? But I couldn't tell him that. Because you don't want to make your sponsor unhappy. You know, you have to please them. So I just figured, you know, I guess I'm on step one. I guess that's what I'm on is step one, because everyone else seems to be on step one, so it may as well be me too. So I said, I'm on step one. And he said, what does step one say? Well, thank God I did this on the phone, so I know I could pull out the book and say, oh, yeah, well, I'll tell you. Step one says that I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And he said, no, it doesn't, Tom.
Well, I've been in school forever. I've had teachers like this. It's like when you have to do a term paper. You go to the Encyclopedia Britannica, and you pull out the article, and you change the adjectives, and you put active voice to passive voice and turn it into yours. So I said, all right, what he clearly wants to do is for me to change the wording. So I don't mind. I said, well, step one says that I acknowledge that I had no control over chemicals, and that the way I was living had become a real mess. And he said, no, it doesn't, Tom. Mm-hmm. I said, what does it say? And he says, if you look real carefully at the 12 steps, nowhere in there does the word I appear. He said, we admitted, we came to believe, we made a decision, we made an inventory, we admitted to God, we were ready, we humbly asked, we made a list, we made direct amends, we continued to take, we sought through prayer and meditation, and having had a spiritual awakening, we. He said, Tom, if you're ever going to get well, you're going to have to leave your room and join the group. I hate that. I hate that. And the reason I hate it is because one of my favorite old ideas is that I should be able to figure this out by myself. I should be able to go to my room, especially in crisis, alone with my friendly brain, and figure out what's wrong. I should be able to run it through one more time and come up with an answer that fixes me. And I somehow consider this to be maturity. And I sometimes use the image, I think Madison Avenue has done a certain amount of this. My idea of a real mature male is the Marlboro Man. Out there on the prairie with your horse, you know, and a pack of Marlboros having a wonderful time. And as James pointed out to me, if I was ever going to get well, I had to bring my horse to a meeting. I got clean and sober, right? And so I figured, well, the time should come when I, 5 years sober, I should be able to go to my room then and figure it out for myself. You know, and finally, willpower and discipline and organize, the spiritual rule on this is none of us can fix ourselves. None of us can fix ourselves. It just doesn't work. And when I try to fix myself, I become more and more nuts quicker. And I need to be able to join the group. And I, I resent it. That's true. If I was going to reword the first step, and I do that sometimes, I do say, these are not carved in stone, you know, these are to be used. And the tool I use on this, I think what step one basically says is awful, isn't it? It doesn't say, are you having a bad day? It doesn't say, are things a little slow? It doesn't say, is your drinking inconveniencing you? It says, would you please just acknowledge that what you are living in is an unmitigated horror, you see? And when I'm willing to admit that, that's step one. Now, the thing with step one is I stayed on step one a long time. And I had been to meetings where the topic was step one, especially Men's Stag. And we play a game sometimes in step one meetings where my step one is bigger than your step one. And we compare atrocities a lot, you know, and how awful my life is and how awful your life is. And James had to point out to me that this was not a one-step program. If I was ever going to get well, I had to take a look at the other steps. And I resent that, too. I prefer step one. I think there is something passionate and tragic about step one. And I like that a lot. When I was in college, I had to study a lot of philosophy for a lot of reasons. And I can remember reading Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and those folks, and who cares? But the one that really excited me was Albert Camus. And that's because, and I was like 21 years old at the time, Camus said that the only serious philosophical question of the 20th century was, why not kill yourself? I like that. I think that man has an insight, you know? Part of that was because I always felt shallow and dumb. And if you're suicidal, or at least if you talk about suicide a lot, people think you're deep. And I wanted people to think I was deep and wrote poetry. And so I would drink and smoke a little and write. Very depressing things. I thought depression was real. I really did live in step one for years. It was awful. And I finally had to acknowledge it and admit it and then take a look at that awful second step, which for me has been the most difficult step. See, I like despair. Despair is one of my favorite feelings. And I guess I was in my early 20s when I figured out that the problem with good feelings and the problems with closeness and the problems with being upbeat is that it passes. But a good depression can last for months. And it becomes your best friend. And you know who you are. How are you, Tom? Depressed and angry. Gee, you were depressed and angry last year. Yes, I'm consistent. You know, and that... Here I am. Instead of being one of these flighty people who change moods all the time, who needs that? I preferred solidity in my life. So when I started doing... Step two, this came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. When I began waking up emotionally, what I felt was very, very raw. I felt very, very angry, real dysfunctional, and I decided... being this is Berkeley, I mean, it was everyone did this anyway, I decided I would go into therapy. And the book says we can. This is important to point out sometimes because some of us think that if it's not in the book, it's not true. See, which the book doesn't say. The book has a wonderful line in here on page 164 that says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. You see, I find that wonderfully refreshing. And then it says on page 134, God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. I had them, and I went. I was just raw. And I met this very interesting man named Leonard, and I would see him a whole bunch very early in the morning. And we would talk about a lot of stuff. And on one occasion, we talked about family, and we talked about God, and we talked about... This is a... You know, if you're going to see a therapist, find one that knows something about recovery. That really helps. Because a lot of them don't know nothing. You see, first question, you know anything about recovery? No. See you later. Can you refer me to someone who does? Leonard knew a lot about recovery, and I started seeing him. And we talked about the big issues, and I finally asked him my question. And I mean, the question I was my most important question. And I said, Leonard, do you think I'm normal? And he looked at me with wise Jewish eyes and said, normal is 98.6. I thought I asked the wrong question. You know, I mean, I'm wrong. Oh, God, I missed the point. And he said, no, what you're probably trying to ask is, are you healthy? Are you healthy? Okay, I mean, I never even fantasized of myself as being healthy. All my fantasies were sickness fantasies. Late at night, lying in bed, knowing tumors, leukemia, death. You know, this, I always knew I was sick. I know one day I would just be dead, and everyone, they'd do an autopsy and find out how much I suffered, you know. And all my friends would feel bad that they weren't nicer to me. That was one of my fantasies. So I never thought of being, I didn't know what healthy meant. Again, I thought healthy meant trivial and shallow. So I said, well, how do you know? How do you know if you're healthy? And he said, well, you know, how do you know if you're sane, being restored to sanity? And my first thing on sanity is sanity means the way I think. Sanity is the way I logically and clearly put together ideas. Well, I've done a certain amount of work in mental institutions. And a lot of folks inside of institutions are there because they are so logical and so clear they can't move, you see? Sanity is not just ideas. It's a whole way of living. And that's why I said, you know, what sanity is from a Latin word sanus, which means health. So when we're talking about someone who is sane, we're talking about someone who is psychologically and emotionally healthy. And how do you spot those folks? And Leonard said... healthy people are capable of doing three kinds of things. Number one, healthy people are capable of working. Number two, healthy people are capable of loving. And number three, healthy people are capable of playing. And I said, go on. I'm waiting for something I can figure out here. See, and I said, you know, what does any of that have to do with me? And he said, what your alcoholism did, Tom, was it destroyed your ability to work. And I said, I could too work. And he says, I'm talking about every day. And when I was teaching, I don't know what they do in Texas, but there's a funny law in California where if the kids are in the classroom, you're supposed to be there too. Absurd. And I could show up a lot of places once, and I could show up a number of places twice, but the third time got kind of rare. And I just wasn't reliable. And what's also true is a lot of times when I showed up, I just wasn't prepared. I had no business being there. Because I was busy a lot the night before. And I just didn't get around to finding out who the kids were. Stuff like that. As far as loving went, he said, to love anybody, you have to trust. He says, is there anybody you trust at all in the world? I didn't know. I didn't know what trust meant, you know. I figured there might be someone, but I couldn't come up with a name. Just couldn't. And he said, as far as, and playing. My father's Irish Catholic and my mother is Swedish Lutheran. And neither group is known for whimsy. The message we got was that good people work, and better people work all the time. And playing was not just childish, it was wasting time. And let's get to work. Let's get to work. And this was a way I used whenever I felt guilty or inadequate or really stupid or awful, I just tried to work harder. And what I ended up doing was staying real busy. And not getting much done, but staying real busy for a long time. So even this whole business of play was new to me. I remember I was sober for 9 or 10 months, and Leonard said, "Tom, have you done anything yet for fun?" "No." You know, and he said, "Why not?" And I said, and the reason was because I was so afraid that if I relaxed, I'd get drunk. I thought if I had a good time, I would immediately get loaded. And I was going to hold on real tight. And he said, "Well, what do you do for laughs?" "I go to meetings." "I know, but what do you do for laughs?" "You know, I enjoy them." "Yes, but what do you do for laughs?" How about movies? I can remember going to my first sober movie. It was a terrifying experience. I don't know what I saw. I was just sitting there, terrified. But I went. And I didn't know you could go out to eat sober. I didn't know that one either. I didn't know you could go to a play sober. And the first time I did those things, it was so uncomfortable and so painful. So we began dealing with working, loving, playing. And I find out that's pretty much how I identify my sobriety. When people say, "What's the quality of my sobriety?" what I have to look at is, how am I working, how am I loving, and how am I playing? Now, rarely am I doing all three at the same time. But I think if over the course of a month, if I could do all three, I'm doing real well. And I found out in working, not only can I work, I can change jobs. And this happens a lot to folks in recovery. You notice folks, somewhere between 4 and 6 years sober, they reach the conclusion that what we could do loaded, we can't do sober. And people begin changing occupation. It's terrifying. Especially when you've identified yourself for years as a teacher. And all of a sudden you find out you just can't do it sober anymore. What are you going to do? And you find people get jobs in gas stations and sleep much better. And you find people who work in gas stations go back to school and become teachers and sleep much better. Very bizarre. And this job stuff is real crucial. I can pretty much work. I'm a pretty good worker these days. As far as loving goes, I don't know. I think we have listened to too much country western music to ever figure this one out. You don't know love till it kicked you on the floor, till it pounded you up down the side of the hay, and it's 4 a.m. and you're drunk. Boy, that's love. I mean, that kind of awful stuff. So I listened to a fellow for a while, and he talked a lot about loving and how to love. And the best, love is not a hormone. That was an important thing that someone told me. It is not a hormone. Love, in fact, is not even about the way I feel about something. Because the problem with feelings is they come and go. And there are days when I feel real close to you on Monday, and on Wednesday I'd like you shot. So I cannot base my actions on my feelings when it comes to relationships. I have to realize love is a decision. And love is a decision not about the way I feel, but about the way I'm going to act, even if I have a headache. I'm going to act, hopefully, with some patience and with some understanding and with some give and take and being there. I mean, I need to learn how to do that. There was one fellow who talked about the relationship of the heroin junkie to heroin, and that sure rang bells for me. He said the addictive cycle breaks down into 4 basic parts. Part number 1 is called short-term gain. Now, short-term gain means this feels real, 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 real good. I think I'll do this till it falls off. See, that's short-term gain. Short-term gain is followed by long-term pain. Okay? Had a couple of social drinks, and you spend the next 3 weeks trying not to die. This is followed by disillusionment. This is where we swear off forever with and without a solemn oath. I'll never do that again. You call your sponsor. You say, listen, if you ever see me even looking like I might be considering this, will you just lock me up for the day? I will never do this again. And then the fourth stage of the addictive cycle is called agitation. The agitation is, it's Friday night. You haven't been to a meeting in 10 days because you've been real busy. The moon's full. You sit down and you want to stand up. You stand up and you want to sit down. You're real agitated. And you say, I think I'll go out and get some short-term gain. Followed by long-term pain. Followed by disillusionment. Followed by agitation. I mean, we use this with lots of things. You know? And the guy said, what we have to learn how to do is change the formula to have short-term pain followed by long-term gain.
What does that mean?
Well, my sponsor in Los Angeles, who was a helpless, hopeless alcoholic, gets up at 6 o'clock every morning and runs 5 miles. Now, that's short-term pain. To me, that's short-term crucifixion, but short-term pain. And the rest of the day he feels sensational, and over a period of weeks and months his health steadily improves. I mean, that's the thing he is in. I mean, he's in flaming recovery. I prefer, rather than getting up, staying in bed for a little while longer, you know, and then feeling sluggish all day long. Or it's like going through the food line, and you discover there's a pile of apples and oranges on one side and there's a pile of chocolate eclairs on the other. You see? Now, which one will you have? A little short-term gain, which would be 19 eclairs, fast, alone in your room, or an apple. You know? And I just starting to learn how to make these kinds of choices has been a real important part of my recovery. One of the topics we use sometimes in California for a meeting is patience. Let's talk about patience, and we're all chomping at the bit to talk on patience. And someone pointed out to me that the word patience is from a Latin word, patio patire, which means to be uncomfortable. And that's what a lot of patience is about, being uncomfortable without committing homicide or suicide. And allowing a certain amount of discomfort in my life. And I never knew I could do that. And I thought that if I was uncomfortable, this was crisis. I thought that if I was uncomfortable, this is emergency. I thought if I was uncomfortable, I had to do something to change it immediately or I was going to be in serious trouble. And I remember going to a meeting in Los Angeles and I was real nuts. And I at the meeting, I said, I'm real nuts, and I expected them to run to my aid. And someone said, so be nuts.
I can't be nuts!
You know, oh, yes, you can. And it'll pass. See, this gets to pass, and when you're a little lonely, it's okay, you don't have to panic. If you're a little tired, you don't have to you can just kind of start dealing with emotions as they come instead of declaring a state emergency. The short-term pain is allowing myself to feel what I'm feeling, not running from it, and the long-term gain is I can walk through a lot of stuff. This is not an easy lesson for me. When I was 5 years sober, I was a mess. When I was a year sober, I was depressed. I thought I should get, again, the National Health Award for that. I thought I should wake up in the morning and the applause should day. I was a year sober. It should go all day long, and it didn't happen that way. I woke up depressed, realizing that I had been clean and sober for an entire year, and nothing had changed. I was still angry, I was still lonely, I was still tired, I still didn't have a lot of people I thought were friends, you know, and it was still real hard to go back to work. And I was able to walk through that. When I was at the end of my first year sober, I graduated from school and I did have to go back to work, and it was awful. I went back to the classroom, and it was like I had never been there before. It was a nightmare. I felt absolutely terrified. And I heard people say, when you're real terrified, act as if. So when I'd be in the schoolyard, instead of running through the schoolyard, because the kids were there, I'd walk real slow. And one of my friends told me that when he was real afraid or angry at someone, what he tried to do to establish relationship when he talked to them to make sure he just touched them on the shoulder or on the arm. So I started doing that with the kids. I was terrified of, not one-on-one, but as groups. I was just terrified of these kids. And I was sober, you know, a year and a half. I should be well. And I would talk to them, and I would just try to touch them on the arm just to make that kind of contact. And that second year, I had no social life at all. None. What I did is I taught. At the end of the teaching day, I'd pass out because I was exhausted. And then I'd wake up and go to a meeting. And then I would just be there in crisis. And then I'd go home and go to bed. And I'd wake up and go and teach. And I did that for another year. And I was thinking, where are the promises? Where are the good times? I wasn't capable of the promises, the good times. I was still on a basic survival mold. And around 5 years clean and sober, I came to the shocking realization that I hadn't had a drink or a joint or a pill for 5 years, and I wasn't happy. I still did not know how to have a good time. By this time, Leonard, my shrink, and I had become friends, and he would say things like, want to go to a movie?
Oh, no. Oh, gee, I'm busy. Not me. Woo. Listen, there's so much to do.
I just couldn't do it, so I had to start all over again at 5. And then when I was 7 years sober, everything fell apart again. I started feeling awkward and stupid and heavy and clumsy and wrong a lot. And my sense was that my timing was off. I got the joke after everyone else had finished laughing, or I started laughing when everyone else was not. The timing was real bizarre. And I don't know about you, but those are the feelings I drank about. I did not drink about major crises. I drank about feeling awkward and feeling stupid and feeling clumsy. And I went back into therapy, and I was glad I did that. And I found out that what was coming up for me, more is revealed. We realize we know only a little at 7 years, was an awful lot of grief and an awful lot of sorrow and an awful lot of loss and an awful lot of abandonment, and a lot of it was family stuff. And I felt so fragile and so brittle. I wanted to cry all the time, and yet I couldn't. I didn't have the freedom to cry, and so I just went to meetings being real brittle, and folks would say, how, and I would say, real brittle. You know? I don't know what else to say. Everything is very awkward right now, and I found out I could walk through that and not die. And now, you know, just having turned 10, what occurs to me, two things occur to me. Number one, I used to be of the opinion that the first 5 years in recovery are real early years in recovery. I am now of the opinion that the first 7 years in recovery are real early years of recovery, and I want to get well fast. And slow is real. Fast isn't real. Slow is what's real, and the slow changes in me have been the ones that have lasted. Oh. Working and learning how to love, learning how to be friends, learning how to have a relationship. And by relationship, in California, when you say you're having a relationship, we mean there are you sleeping together. And I think that's a real narrow definition of relationship. I think, you know, I have relationships with everybody I meet. And the quality of my relationship is real crucial. I mean, it's nice to be all chummy with your bedmate and an asshole to everyone you meet on the street. I think that's distorting things a little bit. I need to learn how to have relationships of all kinds and all flavors. And that's real. That's been happening. It's been happening. Working, loving, the last thing that Leonard talked about was playing. And I've mentioned playing a little bit already. And this is something that is real crucial for me in my recovery, learning how to play. The motto is not heavy does it, you know. There is to be a kind of enjoyment in recovery. There is to be a kind of enjoyment in sobriety. And if there's no joy there, something's wrong. And there also can be lots of sorrow. I find in recovery what I get to do is have good days and bad days. It's not always wonderful. There's someone who goes around saying, my best day, how does this go? I can't even think of it. my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. That's not true for me. I had some great times drunk. I had some sensational, and I've had some awful times sober. As one of the women in the East Bay says, when you get sober, you feel better. You feel everything better. And that's true. And the no longer the anesthesia and no longer the shutdown and learning how to feel the feelings and walk through the feelings is not always fun. So I have to realize that in recovery, women and men in recovery have good days and bad days. And I get to talk about those on the good days and the bad days and to stay in touch with those instead of being immune. You know, suddenly now I'm sober and I don't get angry anymore. If Mother Teresa can get angry, I can get angry, you know? What I have to learn how to do is let go of the anger instead of basing all my principles on it, which I had done for a long time. I love resentment. I love self-pity. They were my best friends. What I liked best about resentment was it made me feel strong. Because if I really hated you, and I hated some people, I just felt power. And it's a dark power. It's a hard way to live. And I can remember at a meeting in Oakland, in my first year of sobriety, we were talking about letting go of anger and letting go of hatred. And like the question was, who are you? And someone said, well, I'm a lot of me is all my feelings. And what occurred to me was, I if you asked me who I was, I would give you a long list of people I hated. That's who I was. I hated him and I hated her, and for very good reasons. And I had long lists of, and my entire identity was negative. And they said, if you're going to get well, you have to let go of the resentment, Tom. And I had this quick image of being an empty shell. Absolute, like a rice hull, you know, just kind of blowing around with the wind. I would have nothing left if I let go of all my resentment. I mean, I would be an empty person. And I was so afraid of that. I would lose all power. I would lose all integrity. I would lose all everything if I let go of the rage. And someone pointed out that God can only fill an empty vessel. And that as I let go of the negative, some of the positive would start coming into its place. And that has happened, but over a long, long time. The second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to work and to love and to play. And I do see that happen in women and men on the program. But if I was going to reword the second step, all the second step says is, are you willing to accept the fact that somewhere, somehow in the universe, there's a solution? That's all it says. I didn't want the solution. I liked the pain, which we talk about alcohol as being but a symptom. And boy, it sure is. My major disease is a spiritual disease, and it is this desire for all that grief and anguish. And letting go of that, saying, I can get well too. I knew you could, but I didn't think I could. Came to believe, it doesn't say we came to feel. I had a terrible problem with this belief system. Because I knew a lot about God. I studied a lot about God. I knew a lot of good ideas about God. I mean, I'm in fact, you have to hear this from someone in recovery. I have been raised Catholic, and I never heard that God hated people. I never heard that. I heard that God was wonderful and charming and enthusiastic and creative and fabulously in love, passionately with the whole human race, and I believed it, except for me. See, I was different. I thought that God loved everybody but me. In fact, even in my way, it's not that God hated me, but God was indifferent in my respect. By the time God got around to me, for some reason, God's energy wore out, or God got bored, or something. I was somehow beyond the reach. And I can remember, we talk about these spiritual awakenings, and I was at a meeting in Berkeley, and I looked around the room, and I noticed that I was not the only person in the room. My first spiritual awakening on the program.
the next thought was that every woman and man in that room has a right to be in that room. And I was in the room. And I had a right to be there too. And therefore, I too had a right to recovery. I think there are two kinds of arrogance. One is the arrogance where I'm so much better than you, we have nothing in common. That was not mine. Mine was, I am so much worse than you, we have nothing in common. Those forms of arrogance kill just as dead. And in the end run, the distinction is purely academic. But I just had such a low self-esteem. But when I realized every woman and man in that room has a right to be there, I kind of got a little bit of dignity. And the dignity was that I was a member of this group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not yet willing to join the human race, but I was willing to join that group. And that's when my recovery began. I think a lot of my problems with God were not problems with God. I think they were problems with me. And I think the way that works is this. I am God's first gift to me. And if I am terribly disappointed in the gift, I'm going to have a little difficulty with the giver. So my first act of faith in the program was not an act of faith in God. It was an act of faith in me. And the act of faith was that I was a worthwhile human being who could recover, step two. And then I could start. Then I could start letting a lot of things happen. I think that I am God's first gift to me. I think that you are God's second gift to me. And I think that God is God's third gift to me. I think that's how it works. And that's how recovery has worked for me. This third step is just odd. Because we run into this funny business about God as we understand God. And I think some of us figure, well, this is where we have to understand God. You know, so we go to our rooms by ourselves and figure it out one more time. And I don't think that's the point of the step. In 10 years, I've seen lots of folks who should be dead get well. And I see them doing the third step. See, my old idea is the third step is when I go to my room. Have I done the third step yet? Have I turned it over? Well, I don't know. I'll try it again. You know. I think the third step is an action. The decision is an action. And I see women and men get well who do three things. Number one, the women and men who get well doing the third step, in my opinion, the first thing they do is they show up. Woody Allen says that 80% of life is showing up. I think that's 80% of the program. Showing up, leaving my room. You know, bring your horse. Come on in. The second thing that women and men who get well do is they pay attention. Now, I've shown up a lot of places and did not pay attention. I shut down long before I started drinking, and I learned to protect myself by showing up physically but not being there. And I went through a lot of schooling like that, and I went through a lot of other things like that. If I'm going to get well, I have to learn how to pay attention. I have to learn how to be there. I have to be there. And that means paying attention to me and paying attention to you, and that means listening, and that means, you know, stopping the inventory and the decision, just be there. Showing up, paying attention. And the third thing that women and men who get well do is they tell the truth. This does not mean you need to take an ad out in the LA Times. But it means I've got to tell myself the truth, and maybe then my sponsor, if my sponsor's having an exceptionally good day, I'll talk to him. But I found if I show up, pay attention, and tell the truth, what I do is I get out of God's way enough so that God can do with me whatever God's going to do with me. And that's what I mean about the third step being action instead of alone in my room, figuring it out one more time. And I just, when I use these steps, it works. We talk about using them in all our affairs. I do use them. I did a fourth step, more or less according to the book, and I got a lot of stuff done. And I did it with my sponsor, which you don't have to do, by the way. It says here, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Some sponsors don't qualify. But I did it with my sponsor, and the way I read the step is you do it and then you leave. I mean, you don't discuss anything. You just admit and split the fuck. So I finished all this stuff, and a lot of it was boring, and some of it was embarrassing, and a lot of it was just tacky. And I found out, I mean, I wish I were a great sinner, but I don't have the energy or the imagination to be a really great sinner. I know a couple of tricks. And give me a couple of social drinks, and I will do them over and over and over again without variation. You know, it's so embarrassing. So I finished the fifth step, and I was done. And he fooled with his beard for a minute, and then he said, well, one thing's real clear. And I don't like people for whom one thing is real clear. I get nervous around them. I feel they know something I don't, and I never go to them again. But he said, you and I both need this program very much. Got up, left my room. I was thrilled to see him go. And I didn't call him for 6 months because I wanted to give a little time, you know, let him forget a couple of my better ideas. Recovery. We're running out of time, and there's... what I'm experiencing right now is loss of life. My sense is it's just beginning. I mean, I'm just learning how to do this business. And it's wonderful. It's a good thing. I sometimes refer to my life as being very rich. This doesn't mean, you know, financially, that's for sure. There's a spiritual line that goes around somewhere where they think that if God really loves you, you'll be rich, white, and thin. And I think that's nonsense. I think that is a bad idea. I find that God loves us regardless of who we are, and that indicates God has no taste, is what that indicates. And that's what a lot of us count on, you know? But it's a good thing. I do try to learn things. I found out that... the only way to get rid of bad old ideas about God is to learn good new ideas about God, and that's active. Bad old ideas do not die by themselves. They like being alive, and they will fight to stay alive. And if I was going to recover, I had to learn some new ideas. Again, learning how to learn. So a couple of years ago, I took some classes from the Orthodox rabbi of Berkeley, who... was a man in his 50s and a wise man and a good teacher. What happened? I went with Leonard, as a matter of fact. We had become friends. And the people in the class were divided into two groups. One was people who had been born Jewish that had never done anything about it. So it was a rediscovery of roots. And the other group were Gentiles who were converting, you see. So then there was me. And I was there. I am in the ministry myself. And I found that anything that I learned about my own tradition, I learned about I learned about the Jewish tradition, I learned about my own. So therefore I go we talked professionally a couple times, the rabbi and I. Anyway, on one occasion, a woman in the class raised her hand and she said, "Rabbi, what's the blessing?" See, now I think on my feet a lot, and I have these dime store answers for questions like that. And I would have said, "A blessing is the good housekeeping seal of approval." You know, next, you think. But he didn't, because rabbis don't do that. I don't know what you know about rabbis. But the 3,000-year tradition is you never answer a question directly. Whenever you can, ask a question in return. You see, so you find questions like, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? A good rabbi would say, whose picture's on the coin? Caesar's. Give it to him. Next, you see? Or what is the greatest of the commandments? And a good rabbi would say, how do you read the law? Oh, well, the greatest of the commandments is to love the Lord your God with your whole heart and soul and mind and will and your neighbor yourself. You got it. Who's my neighbor? If you can't answer with a question, you tell a story. Oh, Rand was on the road to Jericho and fell in among robbers. And you start this very ancient tradition.
Well, I was familiar with that from New. It made me read the New Testament very differently, seeing how rabbinical the rabbi was. But to see this in Berkeley in 1983 was amazing. And the rabbi was asked the question, what's a blessing? And he stopped. And he fools with his beard, which is why we have beards. He fools with his beard. And he said, when God created the world, God created the world in 6 days. And at the end of each day of creation, God looked at what God had made and said, this is good. This is good. And so God created the dry land out of the water and the sun and the moon and the stars and cows and goats and fish and sheep and avocados and all the things we need. And says they're good. And then on the last day of creation, the sixth day of creation, God created the human being and didn't say anything. And the rabbi said, any conclusions? And someone in the class said, people are no good. And the rabbi said, that's a possible conclusion. And that's why it's a bad translation. He said, in English, the word good means too many things. If you have good apples and good days and a good person and a good book and the good book, it has moral overtones. It's a funny word. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything, you know. And he said, in Hebrew, and he looked over at me and said, which is what God spoke. In Hebrew, God looked at what God had made and said, this is Tov, T-O-V, as in Victor, Tov. And he said, what does Tov mean? Tov means something is complete. Tov means something is whole. Tov means something is exactly the way it's supposed to be. It can't be any different. The dry land is created, Tov. The moon and the stars are created, Tov. Cows are created, Tov. But he said, people are not created complete. When we're born with lots of empty places. So he said, what are we supposed to do in the course of a lifetime? What we're supposed to do is fill in some of the empty places. We're supposed to take some of those very jagged raw edges and rub them smooth. We're supposed to get bigger. We're supposed to become more. We're born male, we're supposed to become men. We're born female, we're supposed to become women. We're supposed to become human beings. And he stopped and said, as we travel down the road, as we're on our pilgrimage, as we're on our journey, as we're trudging the road of happy destiny, anything that gets behind us and pushes us ahead, anything that gets in front of us and drags us forward, even kicking and screaming, anything that gets down deep inside of us where it's brittle and cold and dark and narrow and kicks and shoves and pushes until suddenly there's more room and air and light. Anything, he says, that does that is a blessing. And he says, sometimes blessings don't feel good. And sometimes we don't know they're blessings until years later, when we look back at something that we knew was going to kill us. And instead it opened up doors for us that we never even knew were there. And when he said that, it was the first time I understood my alcoholism as being one of the greatest blessings of my life. Because it found me a very bigoted, very scared, very hostile, very rigid human being. And today it's better. Today it's better. What a speaker is supposed to do at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is talk about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And we're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope. My experience, strength, and hope is simply this. If we go to lots of meetings,
if we don't drink in between meetings, and if we don't use no dope, but instead learn to admit that it's awful, that there is a solution, when we start showing up, paying attention, and telling the truth, we can turn into women and men who are capable of working and loving and playing.